From the carriage, Nyuk-tsin looked at the wet land, and it seemed impossibly beautiful to her. "I will remember this land," she said in Hawaiian. But when Dr. Whipple started to turn the horses around, he saw coming toward him two huge Hawaiians. And when they detected Nyuk-tsin in the carriage, they cried, "Pake, Pake, we have come for the children." They ran as fast as their enormous bulk permitted and caught hold of their friend's hands. "Surely you will let us keep the children for you," they pleaded. "You have such a small house," Nyuk-tsin protested. "It's big enough for children," Apikela cried expansively, opening her arms like swinging gates. "Please, Pake Vahini, you'll let us have the children." Nyuk-tsin spent some time considering this strange request, and she wished that Mun Kai were present to help her, but she was sure he would approve her conclusion. "The Punti and the Haha families might grow weary of our children, even though we are all from the Carthaginian, but Apikela and Kimo will love them forever." So Nyuk-tsin spoke for her family. "We will give the children to you." And she asked Dr. Whipple to drive back to the houses where the children were, and she explained to the Chinese, "It will be better this way because Apikela and Kimo will be able to keep all the children together. But I hope for my husband's sake that you will give them some money from time to time." "Money? For keeping children?" Fat Apikela asked in astonishment. And Nyuk-tsin thought how strange it was that Chinese families with good jobs always found it difficult to accept one strange child. But Hawaiians who had nothing could invariably find space for one child, or three, or five. She last saw her boys heading back up the Pali, one baby in Apikela's arms, one in Kimo's, and the two older boys trudging happily behind. When the time came for the panel of doctors to certify that Mun Kai was indeed a leper and therefore subject to banishment for life without right of appeal, they reported, "Aggravated case of leprosy, lesions both external and internal, banishment to Kalawao, imperative." The papers were signed. The three doctors left, and Whipple said to the condemned man, "Mun Kai, wherever a human being goes, there is a challenge. Be the best man you can, and your gods will look with favor upon you. And may my God in his heaven protect you. Goodbye." Bowed with the grief that comes upon all men who watch the swinging changes of life, Dr. John Whipple went home. 2 days later, 40 condemned lepers were assembled and marched through the streets of Honolulu toward the pier where the leper ship Kilauea waited. As the ghostly men and women walked, the citizens of the city drew back in horror, for some hobbled along on feet that had no toes, and others stared vacantly ahead from horrible faces that had no cheeks and whose lips and noses had fallen away. In silence, the doomed lepers approached the Kilauea, a small, snout-nosed little craft of 400 tons, with a grimy smokestack and filthy decks. Forward, some cattle had been tethered for the short, rough haul to the leper colony, and as the ship rocked slowly, these beasts lowed mournfully. When the lepers appeared, a gangplank was lowered, and nauseated policemen herded the doomed men and women aboard. But when the final moment came when the lepers were to be cut off forever from their families, a monstrous wailing began. "Aue! Aue!" howled women whose husbands were being dragged away. "Farewell, my son," an old man shouted, his face bathed in tears. "We shall meet in heaven by the cool waters," wept a sister whose brother was being shoved onto the ugly ship, this unimpressive ferry to hell. "Aue! Aue!" mourned the multitude of watchers as they watched the stricken ones slowly climb the gangplank, overcome by terror and shaking. In a sense, the lamentation of those on shore was traditional and formalized. But the sounds that now emitted from the decks of the Kilauea were not, for the hopeless lepers lined the railings of the ship and cried back their piteous farewells. Condemned women waved with hands that bore no fingers. Men cried goodbye from faces that had no recognizable features. Some of the lepers were too far progressed in the disease to be able to stand by themselves, and they wailed without purpose, adding their cries to the general lament. But occasionally, among the 40 victims, one would appear whose countenance or character aroused in all an instinctive outburst of sorrow. The first such harrowing case was that of a bright little girl about 10 years old who had left the pier with not a member of her family present to bid her farewell. On her face, beginning sores were visible as she hurried up the gangplank, and it was obvious to all that she would soon be completely ravaged by the disease. But in wonder and confusion, she stepped onto the gently swaying deck of the Kilauea, not able to comprehend the awful step she was taking. Out of compassion, an older woman, also condemned to exile, leaned down to comfort the girl. But when the child saw the awful, chinless face coming toward her, she screamed, not realizing that soon she would look the same. The next case was that of a man well known for his swimming prowess, a big, handsome fellow with broad chest and strong arms. Many came to see him leave for the island from which no leper had ever returned. And as he stood at the head of the gangplank, turning back to wave his hands at his friends, showing them fingers with the first joints already eaten away, the misery of his condition infected everyone, and cries of "Aue, Aue" sounded. This communion of sorrow affected him, and he hid his face, whereupon the weeping increased. But the third case was entirely different, so dreadful that it occasioned no public display of sorrow. It was that of a very lovely young wife, with flowers in her hair, on whose body no one could identify the fatal marks. Her feet were clean, and her fingers too. There was no infection on her face, but her eyes were glassy, so the well-informed crowd knew that here was one in whom the sickness lay accumulating its strength inside, ready to erupt generally in one massive sore. The death of this girl would be horrible, a total disintegration, and those who watched her walking slowly and with grace up the gangplank kept their sorrow to themselves. But she was not to depart in peace, for her husband broke from the crowd of watchers and tried to dash up the gangplank after her, shouting, "Kinau, Kinau, I will be your kokua." Guards restrained him, and his wife Kinau, named after one of Hawaii's most able queens, looked back down the gangplank and with visible compassion cried, "You may not join me, Kealakahiki." And with considerable dignity she stepped onto the Kilauea and ordered the guards to drag her husband away. Impassively she watched him go, and if she heard his frantic cries, she did not indicate the fact, and he disappeared from the dock altogether, crying, "Kinau, Kinau, I shall be your kokua." When the doomed Hawaiians were all aboard, the police produced the Chinese Ki Mun Kai, and since the disease from which he suffered was known as the Maipake, the crowd somehow understood that he personally was the cause of this day's tragedy, and they mumbled strongly against him. Alone, looking neither right nor left, he passed through the hostile groups, until at last he stood at the gangplank, and then two huge Hawaiians hurried forward to bid him goodbye. They were Kimo and his wife Apikela, and without fear they embraced the leper, kissed him on the cheeks, and bade him farewell. With some relief, the thin, shivering Chinese man walked up the gangplank. He had hoped, on this last journey, that Dr. Whipple would be present to bid him goodbye. But the doctor could no longer suffer the sight of people whom he had helped condemn taking their last farewells. Among the group sailing that day were more than 20 upon whose investigating boards he had sat, and he could not bear to see them go, partly at his command. On days when the Kilauea sailed, he stayed home and prayed. When Munkai was safely aboard, the captain shouted, "Open the cage!" and two sailors went aft to a wicker cage that had been built on the deck of the leper ship, and they swung back on its hinges a latticed gate. And when it was open, other sailors, careful not to touch the lepers, growled, all right, get in. The cage was not large, nor was the door high, and one by one the condemned people stooped, crawled in, and found their places. The wicker gate was lashed shut, whereupon the captain called down reassuringly, "There will be a man stationed by you at all times. If we start to sink, he'll cut open the gate." While this encagement of the lepers was underway, two other sailors had appeared with buckets of soapy water and now proceeded to wash down the handrails of the gangplank, after which normal passengers were allowed to board. And when they had hurried below to escape the smell of the 40 caged lepers, the captain shouted, "All right, Kokua's board." From the wailing crowd, some dozen Hawaiians, men and women alike, stepped forward, and in a kind of spiritual daze groped for the clean handrails of the gangplank. They were the Kokuas, that strange band of people who in Hawaii, in the later years of the 19th century, proved that the word love had a tangible reality. And as each Kokua reached the deck of the Kilauea, a police marshal asked carefully, "Are you sure you know what you are doing in volunteering for the Lazaretto?" And one man replied, "I would rather go with my wife to the Lazaretto than stay here free without her." No one, looking at the Kokuas, could have predicted that these particular people would have been so moved by love. True, there were some old women whose lives were nearly spent, and it was understandable that they should join the leprous men with whom they had lived so long. And there were older men who had married young women who had fallen prey to the disease, and it was also understandable that these men might prefer to remain with their girls. But there were also men and women of the most indiscriminate sort who climbed the gangplank to embrace other women and men of no apparent attraction whatever, so that the people on the dock had to ask themselves, why would a man in good health volunteer for the Lazaretto in order to be with such a woman? And to this question, there was no answer except the word love. No Kukua came to stand beside the little 10-year-old girl, and none came to be with the beautiful Kinau. But there was general surprise when the police dropped their arms and allowed the Chinese woman Yuk Tsin to join her husband. And as she reached the gangplank, once more the two huge Hawaiians, Kimo and Apikela, stepped forward to embrace her. And Apikela placed about the sloping shoulders of her yellow-skinned friend a chain of maile, saying, "We will love your children." The gangplank was hauled aboard. The cattle tethered forward began lowing pitifully. The crowd ashore started shouting, "Aue! Aue!" And the Kilauea stood out to sea with its horrible burden. When Dr. Whipple, inland in his study, heard the whistle blow farewell, he prayed, "Oh, may God have mercy upon them." For he alone, of all who heard the whistle blowing, understood what lay ahead for Nyuk Tsin and Mun Kai. He had seen the Lazaretto. The island of Molokai, to which the caged lepers were heading, was one of the most strangely beautiful islands in the Hawaiian group. It lay in the blue Pacific like a huge left-handed gauntlet, the open wristlet facing westward toward the island of Oahu, the cupped fingers pointing eastward toward Maui. The southern portion of Molokai consisted of rolling meadowland, often with gray and parched grasses, for rainfall was slight, while the northern portion was indented by some of the most spectacular cliffs in the islands. For mile after mile, these towering structures rose from the crashing surf, sometimes reaching more than 3,000 feet into the air, their faces sheer rock, their flanks marked by dozens upon dozens of shimmering waterfalls. These cliffs formed at their bases delectable valleys that probed inland half a mile to end in soaring walls of granite. But, narrow and restricted though they were, these valleys were perhaps the finest in Hawaii. Upon the cliffs, white goats ranged, so that a boat coasting the north shore of Molokai passed constantly beneath magnificent cliffs, trembling waterfalls, and the antics of a thousand goats. Sailors, when the days were idle, would discharge guns aimlessly at the cliffs to make the goats scamper up walls of rock that no man could have negotiated. Thus, the uninhabitable north coast of Molokai was completely cut off from the gentle meadows of the south coast, where some 2,000 normal islanders lived. Jutting out from the isolated yet magnificent northern coast stood the Thumb of the Gauntlet, a small, verdant peninsula that had been formed millions of years later than the main island. For when the initial volcanoes that accounted for Molokai had long since died away, an afterthought eruption occurred offshore. It did not rise from a major volcano, nor did it build a major island. It was content merely to add a peninsula of lovely proportions, from whose grassy shores one could look west and east toward the towering cliffs. It was a majestic spot, a poem of nature, and from the earliest memories of Hawaiian history, fortunate fishermen had lived here, building themselves a good community and calling it Kalawao. Then, in 1865, the year in which the key has left China, the Hawaiian government tardily faced up to the fact that in the strange new disease called maipake, it faced an epidemic of the most virulent sort. It was ironic that leprosy should have been named the Chinese sickness, for the scourge neither came from China, nor did it especially affect the Chinese. But some kind of quarantine was necessary, and the heavenly peninsula of Kalawao was nominated to be the lazaretto. It was generally known that leprosy was contagious, but no one knew of a cure. So in frenzied eagerness to take some kind of action, the government's medical advisers said, "At least we can isolate the afflicted." In desperation, the lepers were hunted down. The Hawaiians living at Kalawao were exiled forever from their peninsula, and the Kilauea started its dismal voyages to the lazaretto. In the previous history of the world, no such hellish spot had ever stood in such heavenly surroundings. On the first day of November, 1870, the ferry Kilauea stood off the eastern edge of the peninsula, dropped anchor some 100 yards from the cliff-lined shore, and rolled with the surf beneath the leaping goats. The captain ordered one section of the deck railing removed, and sailors began shoving into the sea huge casks of salt beef, cured salmon, and dehydrated poi. When the cargo was thus thrown into the waves, lepers from Kalawao swam out to the ship and started guiding the stores to shore, for the colony had no pier at which supplies could be landed in an orderly way. Now from the front of the ship, cattle were led aft, and amidst great bellowing were shoved into the ocean, where swimming lepers leaped upon their backs and guided them to shore. Occasionally, a frightened cow would toss her rider and head for the open sea, but stout swimmers would overtake her and force her toward the land. A sailor, tiring of the sport provided by the swimmers, discharged his musket aimlessly at the cliffs, and from their cage the lepers saw wild goats leap up the cliffs like the flight of song, flying from crag to crag, and these white animals became the symbol of a freedom forever lost to them. A longboat was lowered, with three sailors at the oars, and the police marshal who had accompanied the lepers ordered the cage open and called off names, and saw each afflicted man and woman into the boat. There the government's responsibility ended, for the policeman did not enter the boat himself. He watched it move toward the shore, dump its human cargo on the beach, and return. Then he checked off another complement, and in this way the 40 lepers were thrown ashore with no stores of clothing, no money, no food, and no medicine. When the condemned were all ashore, the marshal announced formally to the kokuas, "You are now free to accompany your husbands and wives, but you do so of your own free will. The government has no concern in what you are about to do. Is it your wish to go ashore and live with the lepers?" The kokuas, staring with horrified fascination at the lazaretto, could barely scrape their tongues with words. I am willing, an old man rasped, and he climbed down into the boat. I am willing, a young wife reported, and with trepidation she went down. Finally the marshal asked Nyuk Tsin, Do you do this thing of your own free will? And she replied, I am willing. The longboat set out for shore, and Nyuk Tsin approached the leper settlement at Kalawao. She was surprised to see, as the green peninsula grew near, that it contained practically no houses, and she asked one of the rowers in Hawaiian, Where are the houses? And he replied, unable to look her in the eyes, There are no houses. And there were none, to speak of. There were a few grass huts, a few remnants of homes left by the Hawaiians who had been expelled 5 years before. But there were no houses as such, nor any hospital, nor store, nor government building, nor functioning church, nor roads, nor doctors, nor nurses. In panic, Nyuk Tsin stared at the inviting natural setting and looked for signs of community life. There were no police, no officials of any kind, no ministers, no mothers with families, no one selling cloth, no one making poi. The prow of the longboat struck shore, but no one moved. The sailors waited, and then one said, as if ashamed to be part of this dismal scene, This is Kalawao. Appalled by what faced them, the kokuas rose and left the boat. Aloha, the sailor cried as the boat withdrew for the last time. The Kilauea put back out to sea, and Nyuk Tsin, trying to find Mun Kai among the stranded lepers, cried to no one, Where is the hospital? Her plea was heard by a big, tall Hawaiian man, known to the lepers as Kaulo Nui, Big Saul of the Bible. He had no nose and few fingers, but he was still a powerful man, and he came to Nyuk Tsin and shouted in Hawaiian, Here there is no law, there is nothing but what I command. The newcomers were as frightened by this state of affairs as was Nyuk Tsin, but Big Saul ignored them, and pointing his mutilated hand at the Chinese couple said, You brought the maipake, you will live apart. Where? Nyuk Tsin asked boldly. Apart, the big man said. Then his eye fell on the young wife Kinao, who still had flowers in her hair, and he moved toward her, announcing, This woman is for me. Kinao drew back in horror from the huge, noseless man whose hands were so badly deformed. She shuddered, and Big Saul saw this, so to teach her the required lesson, he grabbed her by the left arm, pulled her to him, and kissed her on the mouth. You're my woman, he announced again. Nyuk Tsin expected to see someone, who she could not guess, step forward to knock the big man down. But when none did, the awful fact of Kalawao slowly dawned upon her, as it did upon all the others. Big Saul, holding on to the shuddering Kanao, glanced at the newcomers and repeated the news. Here there is no law. Nor was there any. In all of Kalawao, there was no voice of government, no voice of God, no healing medicine. In the houseless peninsula, there was not even a secure supply of water, and food was available only when the Kilauea remembered to kick into the sea enough casks and cattle. In truth, the lepers had been thrown ashore with nothing except the sentence of certain death, and what they did until they died, no man cared. If any of the newcomers thought differently, they were disabused by what happened next. For Kinao was an uncommonly pretty girl, and the fact that she had no open lesions made her extraordinary in the doomed community, so that Big Saul and his rowdier companions became excited by her beauty and could not wait till nightfall, when such things usually occurred, and three of them dragged her behind a wall that still stood, a remnant of a house where a family of fishermen had once lived,